Terrible Tommy, come on down. You're the host of the Insurgent Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in North Central Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to eat, but mostly drink. Also nearby is Terrible Tommy's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, the insurgent, just plain old box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
Howdy out there, boys and girls. It's your stranger. Terrible Tommy's back in the bunker after a lot of stuff been going on around here, I'll tell you that. Yeah, I still don't have it all figured out here after the... I don't know. Maybe was that Morris D. sent that lightning bolt into my yard out here? I'll tell you. He's mean enough to do that, I'll tell you. But anyhow, we're back in the saddle again. Hopefully for a while, man, I'll tell you. I'll tell you one thing. I've been through a lot of lightning storms, but that lightning bolt that hit only about 15 feet from my bed in my bedroom and it hit out in a yard on the fence. I thought I was in Vietnam or the Middle East someplace, and the ISIS was after me. That was the loudest noise I'd heard in a long time, if ever. I stood there just like a rock. I was frozen. And so was my lady. Yeah. Okay, let's get on with this. Now today we're going to do something. Now I've come upon a new source of good information. As you know, for years we published a newspaper. 20, 30 years? Yeah. Well, we got a tremendous amount of articles in those papers. So I've got the program here, the program's equipment, and so does my webmaster. Yeah, my co-host. She does a great job when I have to go someplace. Yeah, and so we're going to take these really good articles like John Jewell and put them on audio and send them out to you. I think you'll really get an education. And if you got kids around, you should educate them the right way on history, the history of the United States. So today we're going to see if we can get that going here with Rob the Trains, man. Rob the Trains.
Bloody Railroad Wars by John Jewell, Part 1. Imperialism has now reached a degree of almost scientific perfection. It uses white workers to conquer the non-white workers of the colonies. Then, it hurls the non-white workers of one colony against those of another non-white colony. Finally, it relies on the colored workers of the colonies to rule the white workers. Recently, white French soldiers near mutiny in the occupied Ruhr of Germany were surrounded by French African soldiers, and colored native light infantry were sent against white German strikers, Ho Chi Minh, 1923. An economic panic seized America in 1873, caused by banking, stock, and railroad speculation. It followed only 3 years after Black Friday on Wall Street, when the sordid corruption and bribery of the government by financiers Gould and Risk caused a similar crash. The bankruptcy in 1873 of Jay Cook & Co., after a failed railroad takeover scheme, triggered a great panic on Broad Street and the New York Stock Exchange, leading from Wall Street to the banks and a nationwide credit crunch. This financial slump spawned a major depression, lasting from 1873 through 1877. 23,000 businesses folded. 3 million workers were unemployed, out of a total of 40 million. Unemployment benefits and welfare relief was non-existent. Real wages were cut by almost 50%. In 1877, the railroad magnates, including sinister Jay Gould, who had scuttled from stock fraud and government bribery into a transcontinental railroad empire, announced yet another 10% wage cut for railway workers. Gould, backed by his gunmen of the Pinkerton detectives, could brag, "I can hire one half of the working class to kill the other half." Gould spoke from past experience. He, and every other principal capitalist involved in the corruption of the 1870s, had been created by the sellout of the U.S. government to high finance in the mass murder of the American Civil War. The uprising begins on July 16, 1877, in Camden, Maryland. 40 brakemen and firemen refused to work at a station of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. The next day, in Martinsburg, West Virginia, 800 strikers halted trains. Mayor and police arrested strike leaders. Joining railmen were miners, the unemployed and local farmhand. A mob of 1,200 attacked the town jail and freed the strike leaders. Two companies of state militia, 80 men, entered Martinsburg. One guardsman was wounded and a striking fireman killed in the ensuing melee. The overwhelmed militia surrendered some of the guardsmen and officers going over to the strikers. On the appeal of the state governor, U.S. President Hayes, who had been defeated in the 1876 election but inaugurated after a political deal with Southern politicians, dispatched five companies of U.S. artillery to quell the West Virginia disturbances. In support of the strikers, railway men in Pittsburgh stopped all freight traffic to the area on the Pennsylvania Railroad at Cumberland, Maryland. The state militia dispersed strikers, killing one. The strike then spread throughout Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Illinois, and Missouri. It would eventually reach the Pacific, with 100,000 strikers in armed revolt in 17 states and territories. Thousands were killed and wounded and injured. Major battles occurred, even seeing the use of cannons and Gatling machine guns. Property damage, especially of burned rail yards and stock, was staggering. Whole cities were in the hands of strikers for several days. In some cities, strike committees ran essential services. From the Atlantic to Pacific, police and militias were defeated. The insurrection was crushed by federal troops, including artillery, naval warships, marines, and cavalry forces pulled in from Indian fighting. Most of the events were a spontaneous upsurge of unorganized white workers. But in Chicago, St. Louis, and San Francisco, the Radical Workmen's Party, WMP, led the revolt politically. In Chicago, anarchists dominated, in St. Louis, the Marxian communists, in the West, spreading through Denver and Salt Lake City to San Francisco, the rebellion became an anti-Chinese uprising of white racist workers. The Workmen's Party of California was organized and led by radical white racists. Bloody class war in Baltimore, Maryland. A mob of 6,000 built barricades to block city streets on the arrival of state militia. With women to the front, the strikers attempted to halt three companies, 120 men, of the 6th MD Regiment as they marched from an armory to clear the main train station. When guardsmen attacked the women, stones began to fly. The militia opened fire, more stones and gunshots came in reply. 12 rioters were killed and 18 wounded. 20 guardsmen were seriously injured. In a firefight at the train depot, police killed 7 rioters. A scab, non-union worker, brakeman was attacked and wounded by strikers. The 5th MD Regiment, 150 men, was stoned en route from their armory. 8 guardsmen, including a captain, lieutenant, sergeant, and corporal were severely injured. Rioters were dispersed by a bloody bayonet charge. A mob then destroyed the train dispatch house with incendiaries. The next day, 3 companies of U.S. Engineer Corp were stoned by a mob of 500. A contingent of 100 Marines landed in the port. Police swore in 3,000 special constables. The following day, rioters fired a train of 37 oil cars. Troops and police dispersed the mob. 8 rioters were killed and 17 wounded, 8 policemen were wounded. The retreating strikers fired a lumberyard and planing mill. Meanwhile, U.S. President Hayes had surrounded nearby Washington, D.C. with troops. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, railway workers locked their engines in the main depot roundhouses. Local militiamen refused to fire on the strikers. Miners, other traders, the unemployed, and deserters from the local militia joined the railway men. 600 men of the upper crust Philadelphia militia invaded and seized the main roundhouse, killing 26 workers and wounding 20, many old men, boys, and children. Strikers counterattacked, 5,000 strong, trapping the troops all night inside the roundhouse. The Philadelphia forces used mobile cannons and Gatling machine guns. The workers had raided an armory, a gun factory, and a gun shop. Fierce fighting ensued the next day, 91 persons were killed and 209 were wounded. The militiamen fought their way out of the roundhouse, abandoning cannon and Gatlings, and retreated to the countryside. Rioters looted and fired locomotives, boxcars, roundhouses, shops, the Union Depot, grain elevators, and every railroad dock and building. Liberty Street was a wall of flames for 3 miles. Destroyed were 1,600 boxcars and 126 locomotives. Final costs topped $5 million, an incredible sum in 1,877. The governor declared Pennsylvania in a state of domestic insurrection and wired U.S. President Hayes that local militia were unreliable. The country, he warned, would soon be in a state of anarchy and revolution. President Hayes sent in massive federal forces to occupy Pittsburgh. Tenement houses were searched, block by block, and entire families arrested on suspicion of looting or possession of dangerous weapons. In Reading, Pennsylvania, a mob of 3,000 strikers stoned 253 militiamen. 200 guardsmen were injured. A firefight ensued, 12 strikers were killed, 50 were wounded, 6 mortally. 20 militia and 5 police were wounded. That night, strikers burned down a new bridge, costing $150,000. In Philadelphia, home of reaction, rioters fired 9 oil tanks and boxcars of oil barrels. Police dispersed them and then fired into a meeting of the Workingmen's Party, killing 1. In Chemokin, Pot, strikers tore up track and plundered rail cars. Militia killed 4 and wounded 5. Rioting also occurred at Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Smash the State in Buffalo, New York, a fight at the Lakeshore Roundhouse resulted in 3 strikers killed and 2 militia officers and 6 police knifed and bludgeoned. A company of militia went over to the strikers. The NY Central Railroad was blockaded. The state militia commander, General Carr, vowed to crush the strike at all costs. New militia forces attacked, wounding several strikers at a riot in the stockyards. A militiaman was also wounded. On the 22nd of July, the Workingmen's Party rallied 4,000 workers in Cincinnati, Ohio. The next day, railway men struck. After an attack by police, a mob burned the bridge over the Ohio River. The rail strike spread to all trades in F.T. Wayne, Indiana, including women hotel workers. Strikers controlled the city for several days. 2 gangs of tramps and a band of drunken looters descending from Columbia City were routed. All industries struck in Indianapolis, Indiana, and in Louisville, Kentucky. In New York City, red flags decorated the Bowery slums and a mob of 300 stoned police. They were dispersed by a bloody baton charge, several rioters and police were injured. Coal miners in the East End struck. 45,000 anthracite miners went out in Pennsylvania. Rebel sentiment was especially strong in the anthracite mines of Pennsylvania State. From 1860 to 1875, the Molly Maguires, an underground secret society of Irish immigrant miners, the ancient order of Hibernians, led murderous attacks on mine officials, strikebreakers, and traders. Infiltrated by the detestable Pinkerton detectives, the Molly leaders were hanged between 1877 and 1879. The bituminous coal fields of Maryland, West Virginia, and Illinois were shut down. Wages had been cut from $4 to $2.50 a week. Now, any man who by working 12 hours earned $1 was docked 10% to lower costs to the mine owners. 500 miners in Scranton, Pennsylvania attacked with pick handles and pistols the shops of Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western Railroads, wrecking the premises and beating scab workers. The city mayor had his jaw broken. The mob grew to 5,000. 28 vigilantes armed with Remington repeating rifles, killed 3 strikers and wounded 25, several fatally. The strikers returned fire with a few pistols, wounding 2 vigilantes. 2,000 troops arrived to occupy the city. The strike now spread westward, generating general strikes in Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, and Galveston, Texas. The Workingmen's Party in Chicago and St. Louis, the new Workingmen's Party politically led the strikes. Anarchists dominated the Chicago section, and Marxist communists in St. Louis. Organized in 1876, the Workingmen's Party was an outgrowth of the International Workingmen's Association, or First International, which collapsed after infighting between followers of the totalitarian communist German Jew Karl Marx and the libertarians led by Russian anarchist Mikhail Bakunin. Marx had transferred headquarters from London to New York City just before the collapse. Anarchists in America organized the Black International in Pittsburgh, the International Working People's Association. A Socialist Labor Party was formed in 1878, and libertarians formed a rival split from the Marxists, known as the Revolutionary Socialist Labor Party. A strike was declared in Chicago after a further wage cut on the railways. July 23, 1877, Monday, 40 switchmen on the Michigan Central RR struck. Tuesday, July 24, all freight was stopped. A mass march through the city closed stockyards, packing houses, factories, and brought out the crews of lake boats on Lake Michigan. Meanwhile, police had formed a special constabulary, which included Civil War veterans of the Grand Army of the Republic. 10,000 strikers and supporters gathered for WMP speeches. Constituting the crowd the Grand Army of Starvation, a speaker from the WMP declared, "Better 1,000 of us to be shot down in the streets than 10,000 of us die starving." Speeches were given in both German for immigrant workers and English for native white workers. The press called them the Committee of the Communes, comparing the strikers to the bloody Paris Commune uprising of 1871. Synopsis: a major economic depression struck the U.S. in 1873, triggered by a failed railroad takeover scheme and a panic on Wall Street and in the major banking houses. After 3 years of misery for white working people, the railroad capitalists made massive wage cuts on railway workers. Strikes and bloody riots spread through Maryland, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky. Large-scale fighting saw hundreds of white men, women, and children murdered by state troops and the regular armed forces. On the 23rd and 24th of July, 1877, fighting broke out in Chicago. Looting gun shops were plundered of 150 revolvers, 50 rifles, and a gross of brass knuckles. Strikers seized railway yards and derailed a passing train. Wednesday, July 25, all trades went out, including tanneries, stoneworks, brickyards, furniture factories, lumberyards, livery stables, distilleries. After police viciously clubbed a band of youths in a freight yard, an enraged mob of 20,000 attacked police. Three rioters were killed and nine wounded, the total was actually higher, but many riot casualties were carted away privately. Four police were wounded, one fatally. Strikers seized the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad roundhouse, extinguishing all engine fires. Police arrived, killing five. That night, a mass working man's party, WMP, rally held at Market and Madison Streets, was attacked by police. Thursday, July 26, the Illinois 2nd Regiment entered Chicago. 50 separate mobs battled police and militia. In a running fight at the Halsted Street Viaduct and railroad tracks below, 6 police were shot, 18 rioters were killed and 32 wounded, and the city viaduct destroyed. Police raided a meeting of cabinet makers discussing the 8-hour day, killing one and beating the others. A riot of Bohemian, Czech, women stoned police, a 14-year-old girl was shot. Rioters swelled to 25,000. U.S. regulars and cavalry were pulled in from fighting Sioux and Cheyenne Indians. The city of Chicago was retaken for the master class, with a total of 30 killed and 100 wounded. One policeman died of wounds. Among those killed was a leader of the Workingmen's Party, Frank Norbeck. Another WMP leader, Nicholas Schilling, was wounded. Part 2, Marxists in St. Louis, Indiana. St. Louis, a general strike was erratically led by an executive committee formed by a coalition of minor trade union officials and the Workingmen's Party. The WMP was dominated by Marxist communists, mostly German immigrants from the failed 1848-1849 revolution in Germany and active in St. Louis since the start of the U.S. Civil War. The German Marxists had included several high-ranking Union generals, radical and liberal Republican politicians, and occupation agents during the crushing of the popular Southern insurgency in rural Missouri. Several of the WMP leaders were former members of the International Workingmen's Association, and one in St. Louis, James Cope, had aided Karl Marx at the inauguration of the IWA in London, 1864. Monday, July 23, 1877, railway and Vulcan iron workers rallied in support of the striking railway workers attacked by federal troops in Pennsylvania. St. Louis newspapers bannered the reports under the heading, War News. At the same time, another mass rally of workers called on the mayor to demand that troops not be dispatched to St. Louis, the city of Little Bread. Tuesday, July 24, worker committees visited hundreds of shops, asking workers to strike. Especially active were groups of coopers. 1,500 mechanics and molders organized a marching band protest through the city streets, armed with clubs and slaves. A mass night rally followed. Meanwhile, the WMP and trade union leaders had organized a strike executive committee, demanding an 8-hour day and the abolition of child labor. Fearful of the mob in the streets, which they could not control, the Marxist and trade unionists also denounced the use of violence. 25 of July, Wednesday. Railway workers shut down the yards in East St. Louis. Marching through the city, 5,000 strong with a worker at their head carrying a loaf of bread stuck on a flagpole, the strikers shut virtually every factory and shop. Cannery and stove foundry workers joined, as well as Black River levee roustabouts. Several bakeries were looted and a dry goods store in the North Side slums. The executive committee intervened to operate essential services, running trains, distributing bread, and assuring that workers continued to process sugar at a mill facing spoiled supplies, under the guard of a 200-man worker militia. The mayor of East St. Louis, a German refugee from the 1848 Revolution, formed a special police force from strikers to maintain order in his section. The city mayor and chief of police in St. Louis properly admitted they had no control over the situation. Secretly, they began to take orders from a businessmen's vigilante force, the Committee of Public Safety, overseen by former Confederate and Missouri state militia officers. The committee requisitioned funds, supplies, and arms, issuing receipts in its own name. That same day, July 25, 1877, in London, the German Jew Karl Marx, on reading transatlantic telegraphic reports from America, hailed the events as the first explosion against the Civil War. It will naturally again be suppressed, but can very well form the point of origin of an earnest workers' party. A nice sauce is being stirred over there, and the transfer of the International to the United States may obtain very remarkable post-festum opportunities. Marx had earlier hailed Irish revolts and the American Civil War, in which his followers were active in New York City, St. Louis, etc., as the beginning of the World Revolution. With the press shrieking against the rule of the rabble and comparing it to the recent bloody Paris Commune revolt in France, U.S. President Hayes decided on federal intervention. 6 companies of troops were dispatched by train from Indian Fighting in the West to St. Louis, via Kansas. They were temporarily halted by railway strikers in Kansas City and in Sedalia, Missouri. 26th day of July, Thursday, 3 companies of infantry and a boxcar of arms entered St. Louis and joined the Vigilante Committee of Public Safety. When workers led a mass protest rally in the streets, the frightened Executive Committee of Trade Unionists and the Marxists of the WMP counseled surrender and disassociated themselves from the mob. 27th of July, Friday. 2 more companies of troops arrived with another load of arms. The businessmen's militia attacked a mass rally of workers and then arrested 75 leaders of the WMP at their headquarters, who, after a protest attack by enraged workers, had just finished officially denouncing the workers' rally. On the 28th of July, Saturday, federal troops occupied East St. Louis, breaking the strike, although scattered resistance occurred for another week. The strike had meantime leapfrogged west along the rail and telegraph lines, though Denver and Salt Lake City of San Francisco, California on the Pacific Ocean. It had now become a radical white racist struggle against Chinese scab labor and the white capitalists importing cheap Chinese coolie slaves. Radical white racists Chinese in California numbered 100,000 by 1870, brought in by large companies to work on the railroads and in gold mining operations. Working at substandard rates and living in filthy hovels and on garbage for food, the Chinese coolies caused the mass layoffs of, not only white workers, but also Hispanics. Racial animosity arose as early as the first gold rush in the 1850s. The California Mexican bandit Joaquin Murrieta specialized in the mass murder of Chinese, along with selective whites, as would Pancho Villa later in northern Mexico. A U.S. treaty signed with China in 1868 assured the full right of Chinese to enter the United States. In 1870, white labor demonstrations against Chinese scabs erupted across California. In 1871, whites in Los Angeles invaded Chinatown, sacked their quarters and killed a score of Chinese. White miners ousted Chinese from the work camps at French Canal and Nevada City. Several Chinese were lynched. The nationwide slump struck California in 1873. Whites were mass fired and replaced by Chinese. By 1877, over 16,000 white workers were unemployed in San Francisco alone. Between 1873 to 1877, capitalists brought in another 70,000 Chinese. The Chinese scabs dominated railroad construction, mining, boot and shoe manufacture, cigar making and broom fashioning. As a white capitalist said, "All I want is muscle power. I don't care if it's Chinese, white, horse, or mule." July-August 1877, white workers erupted in anti-Chinese riots. In San Francisco, white workers set fire to the Chinese coolie quarters and a lumber yard near the Pacific Mail dock, where Chinese offloaded. Five were killed and scores wounded by revolver shots. An employer's vigilante was shot to death, and one rioter was killed while slashing a fire hose. White rioters then shot two police and injured three with stones. A Chinese criminal gang, the Tong, rioted in Chinatown. In September 1877, Irishman Dennis Carney spoke to a mob of white workers across from San Francisco's City Hall. Carney shouted, "The Chinese must go," and demanded jobs and increased wages for whites. On September 21, 1877, Carney and his comrades organized a western branch of the WMP, the Workingmen's Party of California. Their platform demanded the exclusion of all Chinese, fair treatment for whites, the reform of banking practices, the granting of state land only to farmers and settlers and not to the railroads and real estate speculators, the breakup of the Central Pacific RR and other monopolies and trusts, heavy taxation of large corporations, an 8-hour day, and universal education with an emphasis on vocational training. The 23rd of September 1877, Carney declared to a crowd that he meant to wrest government from the hands of the rich and place it in the hands of the people, and to rid the country of cheap Chinese labor. On October 29, 1877, a large mob of white workers rallied on Nob Hill, home of the rich in San Francisco. Bonfires were lit across from the mansion of George Crocker, chief of the Oriental and Occidental Steamship Line, which specialized in bringing Chinese to San Francisco. Carney shouted that the problem could be solved by a little judicious hanging of robber capitalists. The Chinese he described as leprous, rat-eating Chinese slaves. A week later, Carney and five aides were arrested and jailed on charges of incitement to riot. 3 weeks later, public pressure caused the charges to be dropped and the white men freed. The white workers celebrated in a mass rally on Thanksgiving Day, marching through San Francisco, 10,000 strong. In January 1878, a California state convention of the Workingmen's Party convened and called for the state government to hold a state constitutional convention and incorporate the Workingmen's Party platform into California's basic laws. A torchlight parade wound through San Francisco. On January 10, 1878, Kearny called for support not only at the ballot box, but at the bullet box, if necessary. On the 14th of January, Kearny declared that the Chinese must be ousted, if it takes the life of every white man in California. In late January, at a rally outside City Hall, Kearny threatened to lead his followers to blow up the Pacific steamship steamers and docks and to invade the Chinese quarters with firearms and infernal machines, bombs. William T. Coleman, a prominent merchant, financed 6,000 vigilantes to halt Kearny until federal forces arrived. The U.S. Navy then landed men of war in San Francisco to protect the government mail docks, as well as the nearby steamship docks for offloading Chinese slaves purchased from China merchants. Kearny was again arrested and jailed, although quickly released after public outrage. The bought California legislature passed a state law making it a felony to incite or commit acts of violence against persons or property. Back amongst his white fellow workers, Kearny began to use a code language at public rallies. For instance, the term "serve the Chinamen coffee and donuts" meant to attack the Chinese quarters with incendiaries and firearms. In the 1878 election, the Workingmen's Party elected the mayors of San Francisco, Oakland, and Sacramento, a number of judges, and one-third of the delegates to a state constitutional convention. At the state constitutional convention, the workingmen's delegates failed to win the economic demands of the white working class, but did succeed in reducing the number of Chinese allowed employment. The impoverished California wheat farm grangers had meantime outlived the grain robberies of Jew wheat speculator Isaac Friedland in San Francisco. Meanwhile in the East, the new Greenback Party had been organized by the radical farmer grangers of the Midwest, their independent parties, and the labor reformers, the National Labor Union. The National Greenback Party ran in the 1878 midterm state and congressional elections on a platform of reduced work hours, the abolition of contract alien and convict labor, controlled immigration, banking reform, the issue of government fiat money to eliminate the privileged classes, silver coinage, the sale of public land only to actual settlers, the control of railroad and warehouse rates, the establishment of a government labor bureau, and the reform of the civil service. The National Greenback Party garnered 1 million votes in state elections, two-thirds of these from the Midwest. 14 U.S. congressmen were elected, and many state legislators. A strong showing also occurred in the South, with 22% of the vote in Mississippi, 10% in Tennessee, and 2 members elected to the state legislature in Georgia. In West Virginia, 18 state legislators were elected. In Arkansas, a fusion with the Republicans seated 7 of the latter and 7 Greenbackers. Back in California, a smear campaign by the capitalist press and the churches, Protestant and Catholic, accused Kearny of taking a bribe from the railroads and of being an unchristian atheist. Kearny was ousted from chairmanship of the WMP for a brief period, but soon reinstated. In late 1878, the U.S. Congress passed a bill to exclude Chinese from the United States. President Hayes vetoed the bill. Irishman Kearny denounced Hayes, saying that Andy Jackson's old clothes stuffed with rags would make a better president. Agitation continued. The Knights of Labor, a radical union not only of trades and industrial workers, but also of popular assemblies of the people adopted a tough racialist stance in its western branches, agitating against the Mongolization of America and the Asiatic plague threatening white citizen labor. In 1880, white rioters in Denver, Colorado sacked the Chinese quarters, beating and killing Chinese. That year, lame duck President Hayes negotiated a treaty with China that allowed the United States minor controls over Chinese immigration, but no right to prohibit it. American money-making in China was too important. In 1882, Congress passed a Chinese Exclusion Act over the veto of new President Cheater Arthur, who became chief executive after the assassination of President Garfield. The California WMP was torn by faction fights. Kearny quit in 1881, going on to become a businessman. The party collapsed in 1882 after Chinese immigration was banned for 10 years by the U.S. government and the naturalization of Chinese prohibited. But the scab Chinese already in the U.S. continued to be a serious problem. In 1885, 28 Chinese were killed in Rock Spring, Wyoming, and whites in Tacoma. Washington burnt down the Chinese quarters. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1888 was reluctantly accepted by the faltering Chinese government in 1894 for another 10 years. Renewals continued until 1924, when national quota systems were adopted. It had a not stopped smuggling of Chinese aliens. In 1941, Chinese received quotas and citizenship. Anti-Chinese agitation also occurred on the west coast of Canada, led by the Knights of Labor. Chinese were being shipped into British Columbia as contract slaves to work on the railroads and in the mines. When Chinese intruded into lumbering and port jobs, the white workers of Vancouver exploded. In January 1887, a mob attacked the Chinese work camp by dark, driving scores of Chinamen over a 20-foot cliff into the bay below. The next day, Chinatown was raided by white workers who tied Chinese together by their pigtails and herded the lots into a steamship bound for the provincial capital of Victoria on Vancouver Island, opposite from Seattle, Washington. Special constables escorted the Chinese back under armed protection. Riots also occurred against Japanese and East Indian Hindus in 1907. The Dominion of Canada finally began to halt open immigration after a boatload of turbaned Sikhs tried to steam ashore in 1914. But, as in the United States, this would not last. The white struggle ultimately failed because although colored races were temporarily controlled, the white capitalist race traders were still left to run the United States of America. Now, as stated in the basic law of this land, the Declaration of Independence of 1776, it is not only the right but the God-given duty of the white populace to alter or abolish the present tyrannical government and to institute new guards for our future security against legal and armed repression, economic exploitation, and the murderous attacks of non-white savages. Blood.
Now I hope you understand by now how we cannot make deals, no matter how bad it looks. We cannot make deals with the predatory capitalists that are controlling both sides of the fence. I don't care whether, no matter what they say, or what Obama says, or what Hillary says, or what Donald Trump says, they serve the ruling class, the moneyed interest, and the predatory capitalists. And we must be, or at least I am, the enemy of those people, because we have hundreds of years of struggle against that kind of crap. So this was a magnificent article by John Jewell, and tape it and spread it around, and make sure your kids listen to it. And because if they're going to survive, they're going to have to listen to stuff like this. And it's got to be the working class, the small businessman, and so forth, white, that have to struggle against all this. But the money's at the bottom of it. Those predatory capitalists, they don't give one shit about any race. They only give a shit about themselves. And so you can see through this article how they would rather kill all the working class people. Like the man said, he could take one half of the white race to murder the other half. That's how they feel, and that's the way they are. And a perfect example is with this predatory capitalist Clinton. She said right there that the people who are voting are working for Donald Trump, even though he's not your man, but he is closer to it and bringing up more issues than the other side. You're low-life scum, you, working class, free enterpriser type, white, are low class. You are terrible people, deplorable people. Now, for that, there was a time when at a rally, if she'd have said that, which she did, whites would have dragged her off the stage and probably hung her. But that's no more. We've lost a lot of ground since the issues of this article came forward. Now, we're going to continue digging out these older war articles, and I think hopefully convert a lot of you people, if you're not converted already, to understanding the way the game is played. It's played with power, guts, blood, guns, and everything. And we're going nowhere at the moment. And anybody that's participating in this absolutely, totally corrupt political system and the two-party system, well, if you know the facts and still do that, you're a traitor to your race. I'll be back tomorrow, and we'll see what we can dig up. Oh, yes, I was listening on the radio during the night and about the tremendous problems over in India. But India has solved the population explosion. And you know how they did it? Well, the 150,000 people a year die on the highways in India. I believe they said 400 a day. So as far as I'm concerned, that is a very important population control program. And the Indian government, by not fixing their roads, are participating and supporting it. So we'll come up with some more of that kind of stuff as time goes on. And I'll be back tomorrow with something just as radical, I hope, and I'm glad to be back in the bunker.
I did what I did for the good of the realm. The realm. Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agreed to tell each other. Gaping pit waiting to swallow us all.